Moralia, Dissolus Animalium. AUTOBULUS. When Leonidas was asked what sort of man he considered Tyatius to be, he said, "A good poet for whittling down the souls of the young," meaning that through his verses he instilled in the young an impulse accompanied by spirit and love of honor, so that in battles they had no regard for their own lives. So I am afraid, my friends, that the encomium of hunting that was read yesterday may likewise rouse our young hunting enthusiasts beyond due measure, so that they will come to think everything else a mere side issue and nothing at all, and will be swept wholly toward this one pursuit. Seeing that I myself seem, though well past the age for it, to have become more passionately affected than before, starting again as if from youth, and to long, like Euripides' Phaedra, to call out to the hounds as I press close upon the dappled deer, so much did the argument touch me, bringing forward its many persuasive points, one after another. On the cleverness of animals, S-O-C-L-A-R-U-S, what you say is true, Autobulus, for that man too seemed to me to be reviving his rhetorical powers after a long interval, indulging the young men and sharing their springtime enthusiasm. But I was especially delighted when he set beside his argument the gladiators, as no small proof that the art of hunting deserves praise, because it takes what is by nature in us, or has been learned as delight in the combats of men against one another by the sword, and turns the greater part of it in this direction instead, providing a clean spectacle, in which skill and daring, informed by intelligence, are pitted against senseless strength and violence, and it approves the Euripidean line. Slight indeed is the strength of a man, but by the versatility of his wits he subdues the dread tribes of the sea, of the earth, and of the air. AUTOBULUS. And yet, dear Soclarus, they say that from that very source hunting, there has come upon men insensibility and savagery, once it has tasted blood and been habituated, in hunts and chases, to the blood and wounds of animals, not to be troubled by them, but to delight in creatures being slaughtered and dying. Then, just as at Athens the first man put to death by the 30 as a sycophant was said to deserve it, and the second likewise, and the third. And from this, advancing little by little, they went on to lay hands on decent men and in the end did not spare even the best citizens. So too the first man who killed a bear or a wolf won praise for it, and then some ox or pig that had tasted of meat set out for sacrifice was charged and thought to deserve death. And from there deer, and hares and gazelles came to be eaten, and in some places they went on to provide the flesh of sheep and dogs, and even of horses. But the tame goose and the dove, a pet of the household hearth, Sophocles' phrase, men tear apart and cut to pieces not, like weasels and cats, for food out of hunger, but for pleasure and as a relish, and in doing so they have strengthened whatever in their nature is bloodthirsty and beast-like, and have made it unyielding to pity, while they have blunted the greater part of their gentleness. So too, conversely, the Pythagoreans made gentleness toward beasts into a training exercise for humanity and compassion. For habit is a fearful thing, carrying a man far by means of the feelings that become, little by little, ingrained in him. But somehow, I do not know how, we who have been occupied with arguments have forgotten ourselves, cut off neither from what happened among us yesterday, nor from what is soon likely to happen today. For having declared yesterday, as you know, that in some manner all animals share in thought and reasoning, we provided our hunting-mad young men with a not unrefined or ungraceful contest concerning the intelligence of creatures of sea and of land, which, it seems, we are to judge today, if indeed Aristodemus and Phaedimus stand by their challenges. Of those two, the one, holding that the earth produces animals superior in intelligence, offered himself as advocate for his companions, while the other did the same for the sea. S-O-C-L-A-R-U-S. They do stand by them, Autobulus, and any moment now they will be here, for I saw them at dawn already marshalling their arguments. But if you wish, before the contest let us take up again among ourselves whatever, of yesterday's discussion, found no occasion to be said, or was said over wine and in the course of drinking without due seriousness. For it seemed to me that something rather businesslike was, as it were, echoing from the Stoa, the notion that as the immortal is opposed to the mortal, and the imperishable to the perishable, and the incorporeal to body, so likewise, since the rational exists, the irrational must be opposed to it and stand over against it. And this pairing alone should not be left, among so many such correlative pairs, incomplete and crippled, lacking its counterpart. AUTOBULUS. But who, dear Sockleris, would think it fitting, granted that the rational exists among things, that the irrational should not exist? For it is abundant and plentiful in all things that have no share of soul, and we need no further opposite to the rational. Rather, everything soulless simply, as irrational and unthinking, stands opposed to that which, possessing soul, has reason and understanding. But if someone claims that nature is not truncated, but that ensouled nature possesses, in part, the rational and in part, the irrational, another will claim that ensouled nature possesses, in part, the capacity for imagination, and in part lacks imagination, and in part, the capacity for sensation, and in part lacks sensation. So that nature may possess these paired and opposed states and privations concerning the same class of thing, as though holding them in balance. But if it is absurd to seek, within the ensouled, a part that has sensation and a part that lacks it, and a part that forms images and a part that does not, on the ground that every ensouled thing by nature immediately has both sensation and the capacity for imagination, then such a person, too, will not reasonably demand that a part of the ensouled be rational and a part irrational. When arguing against men who suppose that nothing shares in sensation which does not also share in understanding, and that nothing is an animal in which there is not present, just as sensation and impulse are present by nature, some measure of judgment and reasoning as well. For nature, which, they say, does everything rightly for some purpose and with reference to something, did not make the animal capable of sensation for the bare purpose of its being affected by something and perceiving it. Rather, since some things are congenial to it and many others alien, it would not have been possible for it to survive even a moment without learning to guard against the one and to go along with the other. Now sensation supplies to each creature knowledge of both alike, but as for the responses that follow upon sensation, the seizing and pursuing of what is beneficial, and the fending off and fleeing of what is destructive and painful, there is no way for these to be present in creatures not naturally disposed to reason about something, to judge, to remember, and to attend. Rather, if you take away entirely from them expectation, memory, purpose, preparation, hoping, fearing, desiring, being distressed, then eyes and ears, even if present, are of no use to them at all. And it would be better for a creature having no use for all sensation and imagination to be rid of them altogether than to labor and be pained and suffer, when nothing is present by which it might fend these things off. And yet there is an argument of Strato the natural philosopher, demonstrating that perceiving at all does not occur without thinking. For indeed letters, often, as we pass our eyes over them, and words falling upon our hearing, escape our notice and slip by us, while our mind is fixed on other things. Then afterward the mind returns and runs after and pursues each of the things let slip, picking them up again. Whence the saying, mind sees and mind hears, all else is deaf and blind. As though the affection that occurs in the eyes and ears produces no perception at all unless the thinking faculty is present. That is why King Cleomenes, when at a drinking party a performer was being much applauded, and he was asked whether it did not seem to him excellent, told the others to judge for themselves. For his own mind, he said, was in the Peloponnese. Hence it is necessary that in all creatures capable of sensation, the capacity for thought also be present, if it is by thinking that we are by nature capable of sensing. But suppose it granted that sensation does not need the mind for its own function. Still, whenever, in the animal, sensation has done its work of producing a distinction between what is congenial and what is alien, and then departs, what is it that remembers, and that already fears the things that cause pain and longs for the things that are beneficial? And when these are not present, contrives how they will be present, preparing for itself refuges and hiding places, and, again, snares for the creatures it will catch, and means of escape from those attacking it. And indeed those men wear us out by saying just these things in their introductory treatises whenever they define purpose as a signal of completion, and design as an impulse before an impulse, and preparation as an action before an action, and memory as the retention of a proposition that is past, of which the present instance was grasped from sensation. For none of these is anything other than rational, and all of them belong to all animals, just as indeed do the things concerning conceptions, which they call notions when stored up, and acts of thought when set in motion, and all the emotions in common they agree to call faulty judgments and opinions. It is astonishing, then, that they overlook in beasts the many deeds and movements of spirited anger, and many of fear, and by Zeus of envy and jealousy as well, while they themselves punish dogs and horses when they do wrong, not idly but for the sake of correction, producing in them distress through pain, which we call repentance. Of pleasure, that which comes through the ears has the name enchantment, and that which comes through the eyes, bewitchment, and men employ both against beasts. For deer and horses are enchanted by pipes and flutes, and men call crabs forth from their burrows by forcing them out with hissing sounds, and they say that the shadfish rises and comes forward when men sing and clap. The owl, in turn, is caught by being bewitched, as it strives, in eager delight, to match well with its shoulders the rhythm of those dancing before its eyes. But those who speak foolishly about these matters, saying that animals feel neither pleasure nor anger nor fear nor make preparation nor remember, but that the bee remembers as it were, and the swallow prepares as it were, and the lion is angered as it were, and the deer is afraid as it were, I do not know what they will do with those who say that animals do not see or hear at all, but see as it were, and hear as it were, and do not even make sounds, but make sounds as it were, and do not live at all, but live as it were. For these statements are said no less contrary to plain evidence than the others, as I for my part am persuaded. S-O-C-L-A-R-U-S. Then count me too, Autobulus, as persuaded of these points. But as for setting the ways of animals, their lives, their conduct, and their manner of living beside human characters, lives, actions, and modes of living, I see much else that falls short. And above all, I see in them no clear striving toward virtue, the very thing for the sake of which reason has come into being, nor any advance toward it, nor any desire for it. And so I am at a loss how nature could have given them the starting point if they are unable to arrive at the goal. Autobulus. But this, Socrates, does not seem strange even to those men themselves, the philosophers. At any rate, though they set down affection for one's offspring as the starting point, for us, of community and justice, and though they see this affection present in animals in abundant and strong measure, they deny that animals share in justice at all, and do not think it fitting. Yet mules lack nothing of the generative parts. For indeed, having both the genitals and the wombs, and the capacity to use them with pleasure, they nonetheless do not arrive at the end result, namely offspring. Consider it from another angle too, whether it is not actually laughable to say that men like Socrates and men like Plato consort with vice no less light than that of any chance slave, but are equally senseless and unrestrained and unjust. And then to fault the beasts for not being pure and perfectly refined toward virtue, treating this as a privation rather than as a fault and weakness of reason. And this while agreeing that vice itself is something rational, of which every beast is full to overflowing. For indeed we see cowardice present in many of them, and lack of restraint, and injustice, and ill will. Whoever claims that what is not by nature disposed to receive rightness of reason does not, by nature, receive reason at all, differs in no way, first of all, from one who would claim that an ape does not by nature share in ugliness, or that a tortoise does not deserve to be called slow, on the ground that neither is capable of receiving beauty or speed. And further, he fails to see the crucial distinction. Reason arises by nature, but excellent and perfect reason arises from care and instruction. Hence a share in the rational belongs to all ensouled beings. But the rightness and wisdom that they go looking for, they cannot say that even man possesses it as something acquired. For just as there is a difference between one kind of sight and another, and between one kind of flight and another, hawks do not see as cicadas do, nor do eagles fly as partridges do, so, too, not every rational being shares equally in the supreme suppleness and sharpness that has been discovered. Since indeed many examples of sociability, of courage, and of cunning in matters of provisioning and household management are found in animals, just as, on the other hand, examples of injustice, cowardice, and foolishness are found in them too. And what has now taken place among our young men bears witness to this very point. As though there really were some difference at issue, some claim that land creatures, others that sea creatures, have been advanced by nature more toward virtue, which indeed becomes clear when horses and hippopotamuses are compared to storks. For the one kind feeds its parents, while the other kills them so that it may mate with its mothers, and among doves and partridges. For partridges destroy and spoil the eggs, since the female, while she is brooding, does not accept mating, while doves, on the contrary, share the care between them, warming the eggs in turn, and the male is the first to feed the chicks. And if the female wanders off for too long, he strikes her and drives her back to the eggs and the chicks. As for donkeys and sheep, Antipater, in charging them with neglect of cleanliness, somehow overlooked the lynxes and the swallows, of which the former go out of their way entirely to hide and conceal their lynx stone, while the swallows teach their chicks, by turning them around, to void their droppings outside the nest. And yet, why do we not call one tree more ignorant than another tree, as we call a sheep more cowardly than a dog, nor one vegetable more unmanly than another vegetable, as we call a deer more cowardly than a lion? Or just as, among things that cannot move at all, one is not slower than another, nor, among things that cannot speak, is one softer voice than another, so too there is no such thing as one animal being more cowardly, or more sluggish, or more intemperate than another, among creatures that do not all by nature possess the capacity for thought, but possess it, in different creatures, differently, according to more and less, and this is what has produced the differences we observe. Socklarus. But it is a marvel how greatly man surpasses the animals in aptitude for learning and in quickness of mind, and in matters concerning justice and community. Autobulus. Yes, and indeed among animals too, my friend many, whether through greatness of size or swiftness of foot or keenness of sight, are found remembering, while others are full of confusion, and having gone out of their minds, fail to recognize the faces most dear to them and flee the surroundings they were reared in. And it seems that in this either they fail to perceive what is plainly the case, or, perceiving what actually results from it, they choose to contend against the truth out of love of victory. Socklarus. You seem to me to be hinting rightly. For the philosophers of the Stoa and of the Peripatetic school strain especially hard toward the opposite conclusion in their argument, since justice, they say, has no other origin, and becomes wholly unstable and non-existent if all animals share in reason. For it then follows either that we necessarily act unjustly in not sparing them, or that, if we do not make use of them, life becomes impossible and impracticable, and in a certain way. We shall be living the life of wild beasts if we give up the uses we get from animals. I pass over the countless myriads of nomads and cave dwellers who know no food but flesh and nothing else. But for us, who suppose we live in a gentle and civilized way, what work is left undone on land? What in the sea, what skill in the mountains, what refinement of diet, if, as is fitting, we learn to deal without harm and with due caution with all animals, since they are rational and akin to us? That is not easy to say. So then we have no remedy or cure that does not either destroy life or leave us at a loss over justice, unless we keep to the ancient boundary and law by which, according to Hesiod, he who divided the natures and set each kind apart ordained that fish and beasts and winged birds should eat one another, since there is no justice among them. But to human beings he gave justice toward one another. Where there is no possibility of just dealing on the part of animals toward us, there is likewise no possibility of our doing them wrong. And indeed, those who have put forward this argument have left neither any broad nor any narrow path by which justice could find its way in besides this one. These, my friend, said Autobulus, are the sentiments those men have spoken from the heart. Yet we should not, as with women in hard labor, fasten a birth charm on the philosophers so that they may bring forth justice for us easily and without travail. For not even they themselves grant Epicurus, for the sake of the greatest matters, so small and trivial a thing as letting a single atom swerve the least little bit, so that stars and living creatures and chance might find a way in, and what depends on us not be lost. And yet they think it proper to posit, as though it were something already established and needing no proof, an unclear and undemonstrated claim about animals as the basis for their argument about justice, when it is neither agreed upon nor otherwise demonstrated. For justice has, in that other matter, a different path, not so treacherous and steep, nor one that leads through things overturned by plain evidence, but the path which, under Plato's guidance, my own son here points out, Socrates, your companion too, to those who are willing not to wrangle, but to follow and to learn. Since indeed that man is not altogether free of injustice, who treats animals in this way, Empedocles and Heraclitus accept as true, often lamenting and reviling nature as a thing of necessity and war, having nothing unmixed or pure in it, but accomplished through many unjust sufferings. Where they even say that generation itself comes about from injustice, the mortal joining with the immortal, and that what is begotten is nourished contrary to nature, torn from the limbs of its begetter. Yet these views appear too harsh and bitter, unmixed with anything gentler. There is another, more fitting consolation, one that does not strip animals of reason but preserves justice in our dealing with them as is fitting. A consolation which the wise men of old introduced, but which gluttony, joined with love of luxury, cast out and destroyed once it had taken hold, and which Pythagoras later took up again, teaching that men benefit without doing wrong. For those do no wrong who punish and kill only what is utterly unsociable and harmful, while making tame and useful for our needs whatever is gentle and friendly to humankind. Each according to what it is naturally suited for the breeding of horses and donkeys, and the begetting of bulls, gifts which the Prometheus of Aeschylus says he gave us, in place of slaves, to take over our labors. And using dogs we keep watch, and pasture goats and sheep, milking and shearing them. For human life is not taken away, nor is our livelihood destroyed, if we do not have platters of fish or goose livers, and do not cut up oxen or kids for the sake of feasting, nor, idling in theaters or amusing ourselves in hunts, force some creatures to fight unwillingly and destroy others that by nature have no means of defending themselves. For I think that the one who plays and the one played with ought to be treated as fellow players, and with cheerfulness, not as being said children do, throwing stones at frogs in play, the boys playing. But the frogs no longer playing but truly dying. So it is with those who hunt and fish for their own delight while the creatures suffer and die in agony, and with those who are led off pitifully as cubs and fledglings. For it is not those who make use of animals who do wrong, but those who use them harmfully and carelessly, and with cruelty. Hold on, Autobulus, said Socrates, and set aside for a moment the door of your indictment, for here approach many young men, all fond of hunting, whom it is not easy to convert and not necessary to distress. You are right to advise this, said Autobulus. But I know well Eubiotus and my own cousin Ariston, and the sons of Dionysius from Delphi, Eocides, and this Aristodemus here, and then Nicander the son of Euthydamus, men, skilled in the hunting of land creatures, as Homer says, and for that reason likely to side with Aristodemus. Just as, on the other side, these islanders and coast dwellers, Heraclian of Megara and Philostratus the Euboean, to whom the works of the sea are dear, whom Phaedimus keeps about him. As for the son of Tydeus, you would not know to which side he belongs. I mean this age-mate of ours, Optatus, who has adorned Artemis the huntress and Dictyna alike with many first fruits of the chase, both of the sea and of the mountains. Here he is, plainly making his way toward us, as though he means to attach himself to neither side. Or do we guess wrongly, dear Optatus, that you will be a common and impartial arbiter for the young men? Optatus, you surmise quite rightly, Autobulus, for long ago the law of Solon has lapsed, the one that punished those who, in a civil dispute, joined neither side. Autobulus, come then, sit down here with us, so that, if we should need a witness, we may not trouble the books of Aristotle, but, following your testimony out of experience, cast our vote truly on what is said. Socrates. Well then, young men, has some agreement been reached among you about the order of speaking? Phaedimus. It has, Socrates, though not without much rivalry, and then, by Euripides, the child of fortune, the lot was cast on this, assigning to land creatures the right to argue their case before those of the sea. Socrates. It is time then, Aristodemus, for you to speak and for us to listen. Aristodemus. The market feeds those who go to law, but for the other creatures their offspring consume much, running about among the females at the time of birth. And the kind of gray mullet they call the sea bream feeds on its own slime. While the octopus sits in winter in a house without fire and in wretched dwellings, eating itself, so idle or so senseless or so gluttonous or guilty of all of these together, is it? For this reason Plato, again, when legislating, forbade, or rather prayed against, the young acquiring a passion for hunting in the sea. For it affords no exercise of courage nor practice of wisdom, nor any of the training in strength or speed or movement that men undergo in contests against bass or conger eels or parrotfish. Whereas here on land, the spirited animals exercise the love of danger and courage found in fighters, the cunning ones the thoughtfulness and intelligence of those who lay ambushes, and the swift ones the vigor and endurance of those who pursue. And these qualities have made hunting on land a noble thing, but fishing has won honor from nothing, nor has any god thought it worthy. No one, my friend, is called conger slayer, as Apollo is called wolf slayer, nor mullet striker, as Artemis is called deer striker. And what wonder is there in this, when even for a human being it is nobler to catch a boar or a stag, or, by Zeus, a gazelle or a hare, than to buy one, while it is more dignified to buy a tunny or a crayfish or a bonito than to catch it oneself by fishing. For the ignoble and altogether resourceless and unskilled character of these creatures has made the hunting of them a shameful, unenviable, and illiberal pursuit. And in general, since the proofs by which the philosophers show that animals share in reason are purposeful action and preparation, memory and emotion, care for offspring, gratitude toward benefactors and resentment toward those who have injured them, and further the discovery of what is necessary, and displays of virtue, such as courage, sociability, self-control, and greatness of spirit. Let us examine the sea creatures to see whether they show none of these things, or only some altogether faint and hard to discern flicker that one can barely make out even by conjecture. Whereas among land-dwelling and earth-born creatures, it is possible to take and observe bright, clear, and sure examples of each of these qualities. First, then, consider the purposeful preparation of bulls dusting themselves for battle and of boars wetting their tusks. And elephants, since the wood which they eat by digging or cutting wears down and blunts one tusk, use that one for such work while keeping the other always sharp and pointed for defense. The lion always walks with his claws drawn in, hiding them within his paws, so that they may not be worn down and blunted by rubbing, nor leave an easy trail for those tracking him. For it is not easy to find the mark of a lion's claw, but men who come upon small and indistinct tracks wander off and go astray. As for the mongoose, you have surely heard how it lacks nothing that a hoplite arming himself for battle needs. For it plasters and hardens around its body so thick a coat of mud, meaning to attack the crocodile. Consider, too, the preparations swallows make before bearing their young. We see how well they lay down the solid twigs first, like a foundation, and then plaster the lighter material over them. And if they perceive that the nest needs some sticky sort of clay, flying low over a lake or the sea, they skim the surface with their feathers, just enough to get them damp without becoming heavy from the wetness, then gather up dust and thus smear it on and bind together the loose and slipping parts. And in shape, they make their work not angular or many-sided, but as smooth and spherical as possible. For such a shape is both stable and roomy, and does not offer easy purchase from outside to animals plotting against it. As for the works of the spider, a common model for women's weaving and for hunters' nets, one could not admire them on a single count only. For both the fineness of the thread and the weaves not being loose or warp-like, but forming instead the continuity of a smooth membrane joined and glued together by some imperceptibly blended stickiness, and the dyeing of its color making the surface look airy and hazy so as to escape notice. And above all, most of all, the driving and steering of the device itself, whenever something catchable is caught in it. How, like a skilled net fisherman, it quickly draws together and gathers in its snare. Perceiving and understanding what is happening, this has, through daily sight and observation of what occurs, made the account credible. Otherwise it would seem a fable, just as it once seemed to us the story of the ravens in Libya, who, needing to drink, throw in stones, filling up and raising the level of the water until it comes within reach. Then indeed I myself, seeing a dog on a ship, when the sailors were not present, dropping pebbles into a jar of oil that was not quite full, marveled at how it perceived and understood the rise brought about when the lighter substance is pushed up by the heavier ones settling beneath it. Similar, too, are the doings of the bees of Crete and of the geese in Cilicia. The bees, when about to round some windy headland, ballast themselves with little pebbles so as not to be swept off course. And the geese, fearing eagles, when they cross the Taurus range, take into their mouths a stone of good size, as if to muzzle and bridle their own love of noise and chatter, so that they may pass by unnoticed in silence. As for cranes, their manner of flight too is admired. For they fly whenever there is much wind and the air is rough, not, as in fair weather, in a straight front or in the curve of a crescent, but at once draw themselves into a triangle and cleave with their point the wind flowing around them, so as not to have their formation torn apart. And when they come down to land, those keeping watch by night support their body on one leg while with the other foot they grasp and hold a stone, for the tension of the grip keeps them from sleeping too long. And whenever they relax, the stone falls out and quickly wakes the one who let it slip. So that one need not wonder so much at Heracles, if with his bow tucked under his armpit and wrapped around his mighty arm, he sleeps gripping a club in his right hand. Nor again at the heron's cleverness in dealing with the oyster, once someone had guessed how it opens its closed shell. For when the heron has swallowed the shut muscle, though troubled by it, it endures until it perceives it softening and relaxing under the heat within. Then, casting it up gaping and drawn open, it extracts the edible part. As for the domestic economy and preparations of ants, it is impossible to describe them exactly, but wholly to pass them over would be a great neglect. For nature has nothing so small that it does not serve as a mirror of greater and finer things, but just as in a clear drop there is contained a reflection of every virtue, therein is friendship, the spirit of community, and therein an image of courage, the love of toil. And therein too many seeds of self-control, and many of prudence and of justice. Cleanes used to say, though he did not claim that animals share in reason, that he himself once witnessed such a spectacle. Ants coming to another anthill, carrying a dead ant. Then, as some came up out of the anthill, as though meeting them, they went back down again, and this happened two or three times. And finally those from below brought up, as a ransom for the corpse, a grub, and the others, taking it up and handing over the dead ant in exchange, went away. Among things evident to everyone are their fair dealing when they meet one another, those carrying nothing stepping aside from the path for those who are carrying, and letting them pass, and their gnawing apart and dividing of loads too heavy and unwieldy to carry, so that they may become easy to bear for several together. Aretas makes their handling and airing out of their eggs, apart from rain, a sign of weather when he says, "The ants have brought up all their eggs the faster from their hollow burrow." And indeed some do not write eggs, oia, but stores. He, meaning the grain they have laid up, which, whenever they perceive it gathering mold and fear its ruin and decay, they bring up to the surface. But surpassing every notion of intelligence is their foreknowledge in dealing with the sprouting of wheat. For the grain does not remain dry and unspoiled, but dissolves and turns milky as it changes toward putting forth its shoot. So, in order that it may not become seed and so destroy its usefulness as food, but remain edible for them, they eat out the very point from which the wheat sends forth its sprout. As for those who say that ants dig out their anthills for the sake of studying them as though by dissection, I do not accept this. But they do say that the way down from the opening is not straight, nor easy for another creature to pass through, but consists of passages bent with turns and twists, and openings that lead down finally to three hollow chambers, of which one is their common dwelling place, another a storeroom for their food, and into the third they lay away their dead. I do not think it will seem out of place to you if, after the ants, I bring in the elephants, so that we may observe the nature of intelligence together in the smallest and in the greatest bodies, neither vanishing in these smallest bodies nor falling short in those largest ones. Now most people admire the elephant for the many kinds and changes of postures it displays in theaters after being taught and trained. Feats whose intricacy and refinement are not at all easy even for human practice to achieve and retain in memory and habit. But I myself see intelligence shining out more clearly in the animal's own untaught feelings and movements, as it were unmixed and unadulterated. In Rome not long ago, when many elephants were being trained together to take up certain hazardous postures and go through movements difficult to perform, one that was the slowest to learn, and was constantly being scolded and often punished, was seen by night, off by itself, going over its lessons and practicing before the moon. And in Syria previously, Hagnon relates, an elephant was being kept in a household, and its keeper used to take a measure of barley and steel and cheat it of half each day. But once, when the master was present and watching, the keeper poured out the whole measure, and the elephant, looking at it and running its trunk through the barley, separated out and set apart the missing portion, thereby denouncing the keeper's dishonesty as clearly as it could. And another elephant, when its keeper was mixing stones and earth in with the barley in the measure, while meat was being boiled, took up a handful of ashes and threw it into the pot. And the elephant that had been jostled about by boys in Rome, who were pricking its trunk with their styluses, when it caught one of them and lifted him into the air, everyone expected it would dash him down. But at the outcry of the bystanders, it gently set him back on the ground again and passed on, judging it sufficient punishment for so young a boy to have been frightened. As for wild and unrestrained elephants, other marvels too are told, and in particular about their crossings of rivers. For the youngest and smallest one crosses first, going ahead of the rest, while the others stand and watch, so that if that one, though smallest, is not swept off its feet by the current's depth, the larger ones may take great confidence that it is safe. Having reached this point in my discourse, I do not think I should pass over, on account of its similarity, the story of the fox. The mythographers say that a dove released from the ark was a sign to Deucalion, diving back inside in stormy weather, but flying off in fine weather. And the Thracians, even now, whenever they attempt to cross a frozen river, use a fox to test the solidity of the ice. For it goes forward quietly, laying its ear to the ice, and if it perceives by the sound that the current is running close beneath, it concludes that the freezing has not gone deep but is thin and unstable, and it stops. And if one lets it, it turns back. But if it does not hear any sound, it crosses confidently, trusting the silence. And let us not call this an irrational precision of sense perception, but rather a piece of reasoning drawn from sense perception, namely, what makes a sound is in motion, what is in motion is not frozen, what is not frozen is liquid, and what is liquid gives way. The logicians, for their part, say that the dog at a fork with several paths employs a disjunctive syllogism of several parts, reasoning to itself. The animal set off either by this path, or by that one, or by that other one, but it did not go by this one, nor by that one, therefore by the remaining one. Here, they say, sense perception supplies nothing but the minor premise, while reason furnishes the propositions and draws the conclusion from them. But the dog, in truth, has no need of such testimony, for that account is false and spurious. Sense perception itself, working through the tracks and scent trails of the animal, points out the direction of its flight, without any regard for disjunctive or conjunctive propositions. And through many other deeds, feelings, and duties, things neither smelled nor seen, but performed and observed only by intelligence and reason, one can discern the dog's true nature. As for its endurance and obedience and quickness of mind in hunting, I would be ridiculous to speak of these before you, the devotees of Asclepius. There was a man who took the substantial silver and gold votive offerings, and thinking he had escaped unnoticed, slipped away. But the temple's guard dog, Caparus by name, when none of the attendants responded to his barking, set off after the fleeing temple robber. At first, though pelted with stones, he did not give up, and when day came, he followed at a distance, not approaching closely but keeping watch from where he could see, and would not take food when it was thrown to him. When the man rested for the night, the dog kept watch nearby, and when the man set off walking again, the dog rose and followed once more. He wagged his tail at travelers he met along the way, but kept guard over the thief and stuck close to him. Those pursuing the man, learning of this from the travelers they met, who also told them the dog's color and size, pressed the chase more eagerly, and, catching up with the man, brought him back from Cromion. And the dog, turning around, led the way back, proud and overjoyed, as though he had made the temple robber his own prize and quarry. The people accordingly voted that he be given food at public expense, and charged the priests to look after him forever, imitating the kindness the ancient Athenians showed toward a mule. For when Pericles was building the 100-foot temple on the Acropolis, stones, as one would expect, were being brought up daily by many teams of animals. One of the mules that had worked eagerly in this labor, but had by now been let go on account of old age, would come down to the Ceramicus, and whenever he met the teams bringing up the stones, he would always turn around and run alongside them, as though urging them on and encouraging them. The people, admiring his eagerness, ordered that he be maintained at public expense, just as they voted a pension for an athlete worn out by old age. For this reason, those who say that we have no obligation of justice toward animals should be told that they speak well enough, perhaps, concerning creatures of the sea and the deep. For those are altogether alien to any sense of affection, without tenderness and having no share in any sweetness of temper, and Homer put it well. The gray sea bore you, said of one who seems savage and unapproachable, meaning that nothing of the sea's nature is kindly or gentle. But whoever applies this same argument to land animals as well is harsh and brutish, unless he would also deny that Lysimachus owed anything in justice to the dog Hyacinus, who alone stayed beside his master's corpse, and when the body was being burned, ran in and threw himself upon it. They say the dog of Aston did the same thing, Aston not the king, but another private man of the same name, who raised the dog. For when his master died, the dog stayed close by the body and hovered around the bier as it was carried out, and finally, mounting the pyre, threw himself upon it and was burned along with him. And the elephant of King Porus, when Porus had been badly wounded in his battle against Alexander, gently and carefully drew out with its trunk many of the javelins that had struck him, and though itself already in a bad way, did not give in until it perceived that the king had lost much blood and was growing faint, at which point, fearing he might fall, it sank down gently, offering him an easy descent. Bucephalus, when unadorned, would allow the groom to mount him, but once decked out in the royal trappings and neck ornaments, he would let no one approach except Alexander himself. And if others tried to approach him, he would charge at them, neighing loudly, rearing up, and trampling those who did not flee quickly enough or get out of his way in time. I am not unaware that this variety of examples may seem to you rather a mixed bag. It is not easy to find a single action of these clever animals that displays only one virtue in isolation. Rather, in their affectionate nature, there also appears their love of honor, and in their nobility, their courage of spirit. And their cunning and intelligence are not separate from their high-spiritedness and manliness. Nevertheless, for those who wish to distinguish and classify case by case, dogs display a mark of both tameness and lofty pride together, in that they turn away from those who grovel before them, as indeed has been said of this too. They, howling, rushed upon him, but Odysseus sat down cunningly, and the staff fell from his hand. For dogs no longer fight against those who have fallen and become abject, once their bearing has changed to match. They say, too, that the champion Indian dog that fought against Alexander lay quietly and paid no attention when a deer, a boar, and a bear were successively let loose against him. But the moment a lion was shown to him, he leapt up at once and made ready, plainly regarding it alone as a worthy opponent and holding all the others in contempt. Dogs that hunt hares, if they kill the hare themselves, take pleasure in tearing it apart and eagerly lap up the blood. But if the hare, as often happens, gives up the ghost, having spent all its breath in the final stretch of the chase, and dies on its own, the dogs, on catching up with the corpse, do not touch it at all, but stand around wagging their tails, as though they were competing not for the meat, but for victory and the glory of the contest. As for cunning, there are many examples, but leaving aside foxes and wolves and the tricks of cranes and jackdaws, since these are well known, I will call as my witness Thales, the oldest of the wise men, who is said to have won no small admiration for his cleverness with a mule. One of the salt-carrying mules, in fording a river, slipped by accident, and once the salt had dissolved, got up much lighter. The mule noticed the cause and remembered it, so that ever after, in crossing the river, it would deliberately lower itself and dip its packs into the water, settling down and leaning first to one side and then to the other. Thales, hearing of this, ordered the men to fill the mule's packs with wool and sponges instead of salt, and load them on, and then drive the mule as usual. The mule, doing what it was accustomed to do and having soaked its load with water, realized that its cleverness had backfired against itself, and from then on, taking care and being on its guard, crossed the river in such a way that not even against its will did the water so much as touch its load. Partridges display another kind of cunning together with parental affection. They train their chicks, while these are still unable to flee when pursued, to throw themselves down on their backs and hold up a clod of earth or some rubbish in front of their bodies, as though hiding under it. While the mother birds themselves lead the pursuers off in another direction and draw them toward themselves, flying up just in front of them and then rising a little at a time, giving the impression that they can be caught in just this way, until they have drawn the pursuers far away from the chicks. And hares, on returning to their forms, carry their young off one by one to different places, often a furlong apart from each other, so that if a man or a dog comes upon one, they will not all be endangered together. And they themselves, having laid tracks in many places by their comings and goings, take one final great leap far from their tracks, and so lie down to sleep. The bear, when overtaken by that condition they call hibernation, before becoming altogether numb and sluggish, first clears out the spot, and, when about to go down into it, makes the rest of her journey as lightly and as buoyantly as she can, touching the ground only with the very tips of her tracks, but then draws her body along on her back and shifts herself in this way toward her den. Female deer bear their young mostly beside the road, where flesh-eating beasts do not approach, and the males, whenever they perceive that they have grown heavy from fat and excess flesh, withdraw to remote places, saving themselves by concealment when they no longer trust to flight. Among land hedgehogs, their defense and protection has given rise to a proverb. The fox knows many things, but the hedgehog one big thing. For when the fox approaches, as Ion says, the hedgehog, curling its body into a ball around its spines, lies there, impossible either to touch or to bite. More refined still is the hedgehog's forethought concerning its young. In autumn it creeps in under the vines, and, shaking the grapes down from the bunch with its feet, rolls itself over them on the ground, and gathers them up on its spines. A sight that once afforded all of us who saw it the spectacle of a bunch of grapes crawling or walking along. In this way, laden full with the autumn harvest, it goes off, then, going down into its den, it hands the grapes over to its young to use and take from as needed, doled out little by little. Their sleeping den has two openings, one facing south and the other facing north, and whenever they sense in advance a change in the weather, like helmsmen shifting a sail, they close up the one facing the wind and open the other. Someone in Cyzicus, having observed this, gained a reputation for predicting on his own authority which wind was about to blow. As for the elephant's capacity for cooperation together with intelligence, Juba reports the following. Hunters dig pits for them and cover them over with light brushwood and loose litter. Whenever one elephant slips in, since they travel in large groups together, the rest carry wood and stones and throw them in, filling up the hollow of the pit, so that it becomes easy for the trapped one to climb out. He also relates that elephants, untaught, make use of prayer to the gods, purifying themselves in the sea and doing obeisance to the rising sun, as if with an uplifted hand, by the raising of their trunks. This is why the elephant is the animal most beloved by the gods, as Ptolemy Philopater testified. For after defeating Antiochus, and wishing to honor the divine in a signal manner, he sacrificed, among a great many other things in thanksgiving for his victory in the battle, four elephants as well. But then, encountering in his dreams by night the god threatening him in anger on account of that outlandish sacrifice, he made many acts of propitiation and set up four bronze elephants in place of those he had slaughtered. No less given to cooperation are lions. The young lions take out with them on the hunt the slow ones and those already old. And wherever the old ones give out, they sit down and wait, while the young ones do the hunting, and whenever they catch anything at all, they call the others back with a roar resembling the bellowing of a calf. And the old lions, recognizing the call at once, come and share the kill together. As for lions' passions, there have been many. Some have become wild and utterly frenzied, while others have shown an attachment that was not without a certain human tenderness, nor devoid of affection. Such was the elephant in Alexandria that rivaled the grammarian Aristophanes. For they were in love with the same flower girl, and the elephant's devotion was no less evident, for he would always bring her, as he passed the fruit stalls, some of the season's produce, and would stand a long while, and, slipping his trunk gently inside the fold of her tunic as though it were a hand, would touch the swell of her breast. And the serpent that fell in love with the girl of Aetolia used to visit her by night, sliding in against her body and coiling around her, but never did her any harm, whether willingly or unwillingly. Rather, he would always withdraw decorously around dawn. But when he kept doing this continually, her neighbors moved the girl farther away. For 3 or 4 days, the serpent did not come, but it seems, went about searching and wandering. And when at last he found her again and, coming upon her, embraced her, he was not gentle as before, but rather rough, binding her hands to her body with the greater part of his coil, while with the end of his tail he whipped her legs, showing an anger that was light and tender, and had more of restraint in it than of punishment. As for the goose in Ejim that fell in love with a boy, and the ram that desired Glos the singer to the lyre, these stories are famous, and I imagine you are already sated with many such tales, so I will let them pass. I will let these pass. But starlings, crows, and parrots, which learn to talk and offer the breath of their voice, so pliable and imitative, to their teachers to be counted out and set to rhythm, seem to me to plead the case and speak on behalf of the other animals in the matter of learning, teaching us in a way that they too have a share in articulate speech and vocal expression. And it is quite ridiculous to leave the comparison to those creatures which do not possess even so much voice as to howl or to groan. As for the natural, untaught cries of birds, how much music and grace attend them is attested by the most learned and sweetest-voiced men, who liken their most delightful poems and songs to the songs of swans and the odes of nightingales. But since teaching is a more rational act than learning, we must now believe Aristotle when he says that these animals actually do this. A nightingale has been observed teaching its chick to sing beforehand. Confirmation of his claim is that those nightingales which happen to have been caught young and reared away from their mothers sing worse. For those raised together are taught, and they learn not for pay nor for reputation, but because they delight in trilling out their phrases and love beauty more than mere usefulness in their voice. On this point, I can tell you a story too, which I heard from many Greeks and Romans who were present. A certain barber who kept a shop in Rome, in front of the precinct they call the Greek market, was raising a marvelous creature, a magpie of many voices and many sounds, which reproduced human words, the cries of animals, and the noises of instruments. No one compelling it, but the bird training itself and striving, out of sheer ambition, to leave nothing unspoken and nothing unimitated. Now it happened that a wealthy man from that quarter was being carried out for burial with many trumpets, and, as usually happens at that spot, a halt was made. The trumpeters, being applauded and urged on, lingered there a long time. After that day, the magpie was voiceless and mute, not even uttering its own natural cry for its basic needs. So to those who had earlier marveled at its voice, its silence now provided an even greater marvel, a mute performance for those who habitually passed that way. Suspicions of poisoning fell on its fellow craftsmen, but most people supposed that the trumpets had stunned its hearing, and that its voice had been extinguished along with its hearing. But it was neither of these. Rather, it was, it seems, a kind of practice, a withdrawal of its mimetic faculty into itself, as though it were tuning and preparing its voice like an instrument. For suddenly it came back to life and burst forth, not with any of its familiar old imitations, but sounding out the melodies of the trumpets in their very phrasing, running through every modulation and every rhythm of their notes. So that, as I said, self-teaching proves more rational in these creatures than mere aptitude for learning. However, there is one piece of learning by a dog that I do not think I should pass over, since I myself witnessed it in Rome. A dog took part in a mime with a dramatic plot involving many characters, giving various imitations suited to the emotions and events portrayed. And when the play staged a trial of a drug, supposedly a sleeping potion but represented in the plot as deadly, the dog took the bread in which the drug had ostensibly been mixed, and after eating a little, shortly afterward it seemed to tremble, stagger, and grow dizzy. Finally, stretching itself out, it lay there like a corpse and let itself be dragged and carried about, as the plot of the drama required. Then, when it perceived from what was being said and done that the moment had come, it first stirred itself gently, as though rising from a deep sleep, and lifting its head, looked about. Then, to the amazement of the audience, it got up and walked over to the person it was meant to approach, fawning joyfully and affectionately, so that everyone present, including Caesar himself, for old Vespasian was present in the theater of Marcellus, was moved to sympathy. But perhaps we are ridiculous to make such solemn matter of animals' capacity to learn, when Democritus declares that in the greatest matters we have become their pupils. Pupils of the spider in weaving and mending, of the swallow in building, and of the melodious swan and nightingale in song, by way of imitation. In the art of medicine, too, we can see a great and noble contribution from each of the three kinds of creatures, land, air, and water, for they make use not only of drugs. Tortoises eat oregano and weasels eat rue in addition after eating a snake. Dogs purge themselves of bile with a certain herb. The serpent, when its eye grows dim, thins and clears it with fennel. And the bear, on emerging from its den, first eats the wild arum, whose pungency opens up its bowel, which has grown constricted. At other times, when it feels nauseous, the bear goes to anthills and sits down, putting out its tongue, moist and soft with sweet moisture, until it is covered with ants, for it benefits by swallowing them. As for the ibis, the Egyptians say they observed and imitated its self-administered enema of salt water. And the priests use for their ritual purification only water from which an ibis has drunk, for if the water is medicinal or otherwise unhealthy, the bird will not go near it. Some animals are also treated by abstaining from food. Wolves and lions, when gorged with meat, lie quietly and keep themselves warm. And they say that a tigress, when given a kid while on a controlled diet, did not eat it for 2 days, but on the third, being hungry, demanded another and tore at the cage, sparing the one she had first been given, since she now thought of it as a companion and housemate. Moreover, it is reported that elephants practice a kind of surgery. Standing beside wounded companions, they pull out arrow shafts, spears, and darts easily and without tearing the flesh. And the Cretan goats, when they eat dittany, easily expel arrows lodged in them, which readily taught pregnant women that the herb has the power to cause miscarriage, since when wounded, goats seek out, pursue, and go for nothing else but dittany. Less astonishing, though still astonishing, is what is done by creatures endowed with a conception of number and a capacity for counting, such as the oxen near Susa possess. There, oxen irrigate the royal park by means of revolving water scoops, and the number of scoopfuls for each is fixed. Each ox brings up 100 scoopfuls a day, and it is not possible to get it to bring up more, even by force, however much one wishes. Indeed, when men, just to test it, repeatedly add more, it stands still and will not go on, once it has delivered the fixed amount. So precisely does it reckon and remember the total, as C. Teges of Cnidus has recorded. The Libyans laugh at the Egyptians for their fable about the oryx, that it cries out on the very day and hour when the star rises, which the Egyptians themselves call Sothis, but which we call the dog star, Sirius. For they say that all their goats together, precisely when that star rises together with the sun, turn and gaze toward the east, and that this is the surest sign of its cyclical return, and one that agrees most closely with the astronomers' tables. But so that my speech may crown itself and come to a stop, let us now set in motion the subject that begins from sacred matters and say a few words about the divinity of animals and their power of divination. For augury is no small or obscure part of divination, but a great and very ancient one. The keenness and intelligence of birds, so responsive through their agility to every impression, offers the god an instrument, as it were, to use and direct toward motion, toward cries and calls and postures, now checking their course, now driving it forward like winds, in some cases cutting actions short and in others guiding impulses toward their fulfillment. That is why Euripides, speaking generally, calls birds heralds of the gods, while Socrates, speaking of himself in particular, says he makes himself a fellow slave of the swans. So too, among kings, Pyrrhus was pleased to be called an eagle and Antiochus a hawk, whereas we use the names of fish, calling men ignorant and foolish, when we abuse or mock them. But although land and winged creatures offer 10,000 times 10,000 instances of signs shown and foretold to us by the gods, there is not a single such instance that anyone pleading the cause of water creatures can produce. Instead, all of them are cast out, deaf and blind to providence, into that godless and titanic region, as into a place fit for the impious, where the rational and intelligent part of the soul has been extinguished, and being confounded and submerged in some last remnant of mere sensation, they seem to gasp rather than to live. Heracleion, raise your eyebrows, my dear Phaedimus, and rouse yourself against us, the men of the sea and the islands. This matter of our debate has become no game, but a vigorous contest, and oratory calling for the railing and the speaker's platform. PHADMUS. Well then, Heraclian, your ambush laid with treachery is plain to see. While we are still reeling from yesterday's revel and still drenched in it, our noble friend here, sober as you can see, has attacked us by design. Yet there is no declining the contest. For I have no wish, as an admirer of Pindar, to hear it said that the pretext of contests set aside has cast excellence into a steep darkness. You have plenty of leisure today, for it is not your choruses that stand idle, but your dogs and horses and nets and every kind of sen, since, for the sake of our discourse, a truce has been granted in common to all creatures, on land and at sea alike, for today. But do not be afraid. I shall use this leisure in moderation, bringing in neither the opinions of philosophers, nor Egyptian myths, nor unattested tales from the Indians or Libyans. Rather, of those things which are everywhere witnessed by the men who work the sea, seen with their own eyes and giving conviction to sight, I shall set before you only a few. And yet, in the case of examples from land, nothing stands in the way. The open land plainly offers its record to perception. But the sea gives us only a little, and grudgingly. It conceals the births and feedings, the attacks and mutual defenses of most of its creatures, among which there are no small number of instances of intelligence, memory, and cooperation that, remaining unknown, work against my argument. Moreover, land creatures, because of their kinship with us and their shared way of life, are in some way tinged by human character, and so enjoy the benefit of nourishment, teaching, and imitation, which, like an admixture of fresh water into the sea, sweetens whatever is harsh and sullen in them, and rouses whatever is dull and slow to understand, being fanned into activity by contact with human movement. But the life of sea creatures, separated from human company by great boundaries, has nothing imported or acquired by habituation. It is entirely its own, native, and unmixed with alien character, and this is because of their location, not their nature. For nature, so far as it admits and retains any measure of learning, produces many eels called sacred, tame to human hands, such as those at Arethusa, and in many places fish that respond to their own names, as they say of the moray eel that belonged to Crassus, which, when it died, Crassus wept for. And once, when Domitius said to him, "Did you not weep when your moray eel died?" Crassus replied, "And did you not fail to shed a tear when you buried three wives?" As for crocodiles, they not only recognize the voice of the priests calling them and submit to their touch, but even open their mouths wide and let the priests clean their teeth with their hands and wipe them with linen cloths. Recently, that excellent man Philinus, returning to us after wandering through Egypt, related that he had seen an old woman at Antiopolis sleeping alongside a crocodile, which lay stretched out beside her on a couch very decorously. And they report from long ago that once, when King Ptolemy summoned it, the sacred crocodile did not heed or obey, despite the earnest entreaties and pleas of the priests, and this was thought to have foreshown the king's death, which occurred not long after, so that not even the highly prized art of divination is without a share for the race of water creatures, nor without honor. For I also learn that at Sura, a village in Lycia between Phelis and Myra, men sit and divine by fish just as by birds, observing with a certain skill and reasoned method their windings, their flights, and their pursuits of one another. But let these serve as sufficient proof that the race of water creatures is not entirely foreign to us, nor without sympathy. As for their pure and natural intelligence, a great proof of it is this common fact. No swimming creature is so easy for a man to catch by hand, unless it clings and adheres to rocks, nor so easily taken without effort, as donkeys are for wolves, bees for bee-eaters, cicadas for swallows, or serpents for deer, which draw serpents out easily. Indeed, the very name is formed from this, a derivative not of their swiftness, but of their drawing out of the serpent. And a sheep, they say, actually summons a wolf by stamping its foot. And most animals, they say, approach the leopard gladly, delighted by its scent, the ape especially so. But nearly all sea creatures possess a foresight that is wary and guarded against attacks, thanks to their intelligence, so that the work of catching them is neither simple nor trivial, but requires devices of every kind and cunning stratagems directed against them. And this is clear even from the most obvious cases. Fishermen do not want their fishing rod to have thickness, although they need it to be strong enough for the struggles of what is caught. Instead, they choose a thin one, so that it will not cast a broad shadow and alarm the fish's wariness. Nor do they make the fishing line elaborately knotted with loops or rough, since this too becomes, for the fish, evidence of a trap. And they contrive that the hairs leading down to the hook appear as white as possible, since, in this way, through similarity of color, they more easily go unnoticed in the sea. As for the line and the poet, and like a plummet of lead it darted to the depths, mounted on the horn of a field-grazing ox, bringing death to the ravening fish. Some, mishearing this, suppose that the ancients used ox hair for their fishing lines, since Kira's horn is said to mean hair, and that this is why Charistai, to be shorn, and Kura, a haircut, are so named, and that Archilochus's Charoplasts means a man fond of adornment about his hair and given to primping.